Hi, and welcome to Liberating Libraries, a project by the Conspiracy of Equality. My name is Blake.
And my name is Caitlin. And if you want to know more about the Conspiracy of Equality, you can check out our website, liberatinglibraries.org, or find us on Instagram at Liberating Libraries. And so, welcome to 2020.
The second month already.
Second month. So it's not really a Happy New Year episode,
no.
But it is our first episode of 2020.
Yay.
And we're going backwards in time this episode to where we actually started the podcast.
Yeah, so we're going to start looking at the works of Octavia Butler today. If you had the unfortunate luck of listening to the first Octavia, we apologize.
It was our first episode.
And we had no idea what we were doing. So hopefully this one is a little bit more interesting and we can dive into things a little bit differently and more productive than we did the first time.
So why are we doing this?
So, I mean, I think, I wanted to do this because I really enjoy Octavia Butler.
Mm-hmm.
I think her books that we have read, they are very prescient. They feel very in the moment, even though they were written in the 70s and in the early 90s. And I think, the work that she did is just, it's very, very relevant. And just very good writing and very interesting. And there's so much to unpack in all of these books.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's really good writing. I think she's also really accessible writing in a way that maintains, it's her stories are so interesting and prescient, I think is exactly the word for it. I was also thinking about this today in terms of, I think one of the motivations I had for wanting to talk about Octavia Butler again is just that I kind of think she was one of the big inspirations for this podcast.
Yeah.
And I've been kind of lamenting to myself the fact that that episode that we did about her didn't end up turning into something that we could use in a really practical way because it wasn't... We didn't know what we were doing, like we said.
Mm-hmm.
And so being able to have the chance to talk about some of her work again, I think, it really grounds me in what the purpose of this podcast is. And we're also going to be adding to, because we've read a bit more of her stuff since the first time. So in the first episode that we had done on Octavia Butler, we talked about two books, The Parable of the Sower and The Parable of the Talents, which were written in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And since that time, we've read a couple other things by her. And the one that we're going to also include in our discussion today is Kindred, which was written in 1976.
Yeah,
I know it's set part, like the present time part is set in 76.
Yeah, so it was published 76, 77, I believe. And I think it's also interesting, too, is even since we've done that podcast, there's actually been a lot in kind of activism circles that have actually really started to try to re-engage with Octavia Butler. So I think it's interesting because she is so prescient, but I think it's also interesting just with the way in which she's being picked up by a lot of activists, which just makes her even more relevant and more important to kind of center and keep talking about.
Yeah, definitely. So let's start with who is Octavia Butler? So Octavia Butler was, she was an author of science fiction and speculative fiction, like we said, beginning from the 1970s through to the 1990s. She passed away in, I believe, the early 2000s from a stroke. She was a Black woman writing in a field that was dominated by white men. Science fiction, and she was very much insistent on the idea of writing stories about people like herself and writing stories that could capture the realities of diversity, but also of the oppressive systems that she saw around her, like racism and sexism that played into her life. She was one of these really interesting authors who kind of grappled with really cutting edge social and political ideas in the time that she was writing about them. Kindred, for example, is a book entirely about racism and blackness in America that also tackles white privilege and tackles the history of slavery and tackles trauma and intergenerational trauma, which we're going to talk about.
Yeah, I think it's she was a very just a really interesting dynamic and yeah, I just keep going back to prescient author. Like she was just so aware of the things that were happening.
Yeah, and so her books won a number of awards during her lifetime. So The Parable of the Sower won both the Hugo and Nebula Awards, which are important awards within science fiction. But her work was also not, it didn't kind of have the reach that it probably should have had at the time. And it's only really recently, in the past like 5 years or so, that she's that her work has actually been kind of put out there more. And actually, more recently, there have been reprintings of some of her books, particularly Parable of the Sower, I believe, just came out in reprint. So did Kindred. And Kindred was also made into a graphic novel that was very, that was sort of widely publicized. And that was that's an interesting thing because it's kind of changed the exposure that people are getting to Octavia Butler, because even when we first started reading her, a few years ago, it was actually really difficult to find her books. And it continues to be really difficult to find her books in like secondhand stores, for example, because they just weren't as, she just didn't get the notoriety and the popularity that she deserved.
Yeah, notoriety, popularity. So like she didn't just sell as many books. So they're just not, they're not there. Like it's almost like you stumbled upon a gold find when you find a Butler book in a used bookstore.
Mm-hmm. Like the struggles that she went through in terms of being who she was in the field that she was writing in and also just in literature in general. And then her own struggles as well with depression and with mental health and other kinds of health challenges. Like she's an author who struggled her entire life. And it comes through in the way that she writes. And it's an important piece of her as a whole person.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Which again, it makes her books so interesting and so dynamic and so useful to think through structures of power.
Yeah. So do you want to talk about what the parable books are about?
So the parable books are the parable of the sower and the parable of the talents. Kind of very broadly speaking, they center around Lauren, who is a young black woman in this dystopian sort of California. She becomes the leader of this group of people where she starts preaching a new religion. This new religion is founded on the ideas of change as God. So like embracing change and making sure that we are able to take change into our lives and always be able and willing to change ourselves. And in doing that, that protects ourselves and our communities. So the parable of the sower is very much the book about kind of her early life where she's kind of in this protected, walled off community. Eventually those walls break down and she has to go on the run and leads this band of people into the safety of this farm. So Parable of Talents takes off from there where this community is being built around the religion of Earthseed. Yeah. And then they are attacked by right-wing paramilitaries, put into a form of slavery, and then kind of them, again, kind of using their belief system, which gets them out of slavery and disperses across the country to grow Earthseed. I mean, that's a really broad strokes thing, but it's just too hard to go. I can't go into It's too hard to go into significantly more detail.
Yeah, for sure. I think one of the key elements is that the story is set in basically charting as well the role of this movement of people in resistance to this rising fascist government and in the context of climate change. So she really captures a version of like what the future would look like under climate change as seen from the 1990s, and also what that would mean for the kind of government that would exist in America. And I think that also speaks back to you know, why we felt so much when we read these books was because we originally read both these books in 2016, 2017, and we recorded this episode not too long after Donald Trump was elected in the United States. And, like, I think that there's a lot to be said about how making everything about, like, our current situation or, like, revolve around the election of Donald Trump is a fallacy and, like, doesn't actually necessarily help us understand where it comes from. Mm-hmm. But there was something about the mood of that moment that she, you could really, like, she was really speaking to the mood of that moment of, like, what, you know, imminent collapse looks like.
Yeah, like, I think for me, I remember so clearly reading Talents in early January 2017, where the presidential candidate in Talents ran on a platform of Make America Great Again. Mm-hmm. Right, so you have this quasi-fascist character being written about in the early 90s, and then at the same time, you have this quasi-fascist who has just won the election coming out at the same time. So it was just like the overlapping of those two things. Understanding that she wrote this book 25 years beforehand, I don't know, it made it feel so real and so raw. Mm-hmm. And, right, like everything that happened in those first few weeks of Trump's presidency with, like, the ban and just all of these other different things were so difficult. And then when you're reading that at the same time, it just feels so raw.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that even now, looking back on it and thinking about what's happened in the last year or so, in terms of the way, the mood that we're having, I'm using the word mood, but I don't necessarily think that's the right word. But the way that we're having collective, like a collective accounting for and a collective realization of the stakes of climate change, for example, and, you know, the fact the IPCC reports that are indicating how little time there is before, you know, before the situation becomes completely untenable, like, that also, I think, reflects back on the kind of world that she's writing about and the kind of work that she's doing to speculate in the sense about, like, what are the stakes? What are the realities of what we're going to be facing? And then how do we actually organize ourselves in the face of that to be able to adapt in a way that gets us to a better place, that gets us to, like, a better community?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah, so I think one of the things that Octavia Butler does really successfully in the parable books, and that I felt a lot reading them at the time, but also now thinking about them in the context of having, like, been thinking a lot more about fascism and climate change, is working with this keen understanding of the context and the constant presence of oppression within the fabric of America and what that means for what those threads mean for us in the context of collapse. Like, how collapse isn't this rupture, it isn't a unique thing, or like the fascism that results from the need for order in the face of this chaos isn't like a rupture from the past. It's pulling on these threads of the past that she understands really, really well.
I mean, I almost think it's like understanding that the fabric of America has this underlying fascist element throughout its history. Mm-hmm. And the way that she is able to bring that into her speculative fiction and her science fiction makes it, I don't know if believable is the right word, because that's a bad way to think about things, but like it adds a really strong dynamic into what she's writing, right? Where it's just like, I'm trying to think of fascism in America as something so completely new and something,
something that's counter to the democracy that America is supposed to be, whereas, like, clearly from her perspective, writing as a Black woman in America, she's coming at it from a reality that democracy is not what we think it is, and also that the undercurrents of fascism are carried through the history of enslavement and the history of colonialism.
Yes, absolutely.
And yeah, I think exactly that. Like it's I think that saying that it makes it more believable is exactly, you're right to say that that's not the way that we should approach science fiction. I think Ursula Le Guin talks about this as well, that like the believability of science fiction is not, like that's not where we need to have judgment, because that doesn't allow us to tell stories. But I think it's more like the importance of the way that she weaves the reality into the story, and the importance that that the way that she is imagining the world. It makes me think about like how different her way of getting to dystopia seems from other kinds of dystopian fiction, and particularly dystopian fiction that's written from a perspective that does see that democracy as a real, like for all of its like dressed up phoniness essentially, and then like sees fascism as a rupture with that democracy, that kind of dystopian fiction doesn't help us actually capture what's really happening. And that's kind of what makes her important.
Yeah, and I'm thinking, just to kind of ground it in the text, one of the ways that, so in Parable, there's situations where people are going to work for these factories, although it's unclear whether or not they're getting paid, though they have safe living conditions and safe, and they'll like, they have a job and food and all that stuff. And I think it's just like, the ways in which she is able to draw this back into slavery, and how like the way that like, you know, trying to present this as like it's being presented by the government and by people who are going there as like, this is a great way for us to like live our lives and be safe. Whereas she is playing with it. Well, like, no, like this has been done before. Mm-hmm. And like, the concern and constant worry that she has about this, whereas like as we learn later on, like it is actually slavery, right? Like the people who go there can't leave. They're like, they're collared and basically a shock collar to prevent them from going anywhere.
Yeah,
right. So it's just like she's able to, yeah, she's able to just draw those links so much closer, and it just provides a really complete text, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that this takes us into talking about the way that Octavia Butler has become so synonymous with Afrofuturism. Mm-hmm. And I mean, maybe it's not synonymous, but she's definitely highlighted as one of these sort of founding figures of Afrofuturism. And, you know, there's an entire anthology of fiction that's called Octavia's Brood. And it's all about, it's all these science fiction and speculative fiction short stories that have been brought together under, you know, what the editors talk about in that is like under this idea that what Octavia was doing with science fiction was like social movements. Hmm. That science fiction is the creation of social movements because it is the creation of alternatives. It is the creation of resistance and imagination of a different world. Or speculative fiction is. And maybe like we have to parse out a little bit the difference between those two. But essentially, like, the connection to Afrofuturism, you see this in the way that Octavia Butler is both writing about characters of color, like she centers characters of color in her book and the diversity of humanity in her book, but she also centers their struggle for their humanity in her book and their insistence on their humanity in all of these different ways in as the central feature of her storytelling. And that really reflects back on this idea of Black survival and Black survival as resilience, and Black existence in the Americas as a story of making possible that which power consistently tries to make impossible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's such an interesting and like really important point to hold on to, like what Afrofuturism is doing in these books. Right, like as we said before, like Octavia Butler was both a science fiction and a speculative fiction author. And I think, like, the Afrofuturism really holds true in speculative fiction. So I guess, like, in an attempt to try to parse the difference between speculative fiction and science fiction, I understand speculative fiction as happening in the near to future. So basically taking kind of an understanding of the current moment and then trying to apply some prescient or some hypothesis on what the future looks like and what characters look like in that future. Mm-hmm. So like Afrofuturism becomes really important into that because it is looking at the future and looking at the ways in which white supremacy is still going to be operating and how these black characters are able to maintain their humanity. Yeah, and like there's so much more to that, like so much more of what like Afrofuturism looks like, because like there are is also strains of Afrofuturism that are looking at just like there are only black characters in the future. And what would that look like in a world? How can we imagine a world where there are only people of color who are existing?
Mm-hmm.
Which are also interesting questions to grapple with and important questions to grapple with. But like Octavia Butler in The Parables in particular is like looking at like black existence in a fascist America. Fascist America ruined by climate change. Whereas for me, science fiction, I guess like I take very much a Le Guin, like Ursula Le Guin premise on science fiction, where science fiction are stories that can, you know, we know what science fiction is. They're happening on other worlds. They're happening far in the future. They're Star Trek. They're Star Wars. They're all of these other, like big things that we know of. I know.
I'm chuckling just because your knowledge of science fiction is so limited.
It is so limited. Whereas in science fiction, it's about telling stories, right? Like, so, like, Ursula Le Guin would say that science fiction, it allows you to get more at the character because you don't have to deal as much with kind of, like, the story itself. So it's about throwing these characters in there and can be about an allegory about what's happening in the world today.
Mm-hmm.
But because it's being placed in different situations or different contexts, allows the characters to develop more and allows different types of stories to be told about what is actually happening today that you couldn't actually tell by placing them in contemporary times.
Yeah, like it reveals things about our contemporary reality that we wouldn't, in a way that like it throws them into relief in a way that we don't get if we only have the reality of the world as our terrain for seeing them. I think in this case, I think about what Amitav Ghosh has said about historical fiction and the way he writes historical fiction as putting his characters in predicaments that are familiar, but in these historically very different contexts and working out from there. Like he starts with a predicament and works his way historically outwards from there. And I think science fiction in a way can do that as well. It can start with putting characters in a situation or in a predicament, but within all of this, like, a context that is both familiar and unfamiliar.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So then what would be different about Kindred? Because I've read a couple things about like Kindred isn't exactly speculative fiction, but it's also not exactly science fiction.
Yeah, like Kindred is time travel, right?
Mm-hmm.
So like it's science fiction, but like time travel is also just, it does weird things, right? Like it messes with time. And it messes with sort of, I don't know, it just messes with time and messes with the reader and like trying to grapple with the contradictions and the paradoxes within time travel.
Do you want to explain what Kindred is about?
I can explain what Kindred is about. Kindred is follows a young woman named Dana. She's a black woman in 1976 America. And basically, she's at her new home. And suddenly she isn't, and she's in the, what is it, 1700s, early 1800s, I think it was?
No, it's closer to the end of slavery. I believe it's like 1840s or 1830s,
yeah, somewhere in there. And she has to save the life. Like, basically, she gets there, she sees a young man drowning, and she just goes and rescues him. Her first time of going back, she immediately kind of, like, she saves the boy, and then she goes back to her current time. And it was a very, very short amount of time that she was gone. So even though she was gone for probably 10 or 15 minutes in the past, in the current time, she was only gone for a few seconds. So over the course of the next kind of like 2 weeks of 1976 time, she gets pulled back to slavery over and over again. Every time it's to save the life of a young man named Rufus, who she eventually figures out was an ancestor of hers. So she realizes that, like, what's happening is she has to go back and save his life, because if he dies, she dies as well.
Mm-hmm.
And each time she goes back, she ends up going back there for longer, so she has to play the part of the slave. And by play the part, she means she is a slave again.
Yeah.
And has to figure out her life there, and, like, what it means to keep going back and forth.
And what it means to be saving the life of a white slaver, because mm-hmm. Rufus is the white son of the plantation owner that she keeps going back to save the life of a white slaver who is also her ancestor,
yeah.
And who's also connected to her existence in the world.
Yeah.
Yeah, and just in terms of, like, the time travel element and science fiction, one of the things that I was reading about was, like, one of the things that makes, like, Kindred is almost, you could almost put it in, like, a fantastical genre. And mm-hmm. one of the things that puts it there is that, unlike science fiction depictions of time travel, there doesn't seem to be any agency involved in the time travel. It is never, there's no machine that's taking yeah. anyone anywhere. There's no agency that's like that's conducting time travel. There's no science behind it. In fact, it's, I think, a really key part of the story is the fact that the time travel, it can happen to her at any moment, and it becomes really disruptive to her life because she and her partner are in the situation where they both could be pulled back, or she could be pulled back into the past at any minute and crash her car or, mm-hmm. Like she's just incapacitated in her life in 1976 because she doesn't know what is happening. And even in the moments where they try and figure out, like, how the time travel works so that she can potentially find ways to come back if she's in danger.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, even then she doesn't really get any agency in that, but there's also no agent acting on her.
Yeah.
And so it's just like, it's just kind of this, it's such a disruptive element.
Yeah, and I think that goes is effective in understanding the story as an allegory,
mm.
right? Because, like, so the way I read Kindred is it's very much about intergenerational trauma. It's telling the story of the effect of slavery still today on like Black people's bodies in America in 1976. I think that's really interesting to look at it as that there is no agency mm. and that history is real. Like, right. Like, so in Kindred, her going back is very real. Mm-hmm. The damage that is happening to her mind, to her body, those are very real things that are happening.
And they play out in 1976. Like, they are material damage to her body. Her scars are still scars. Her, like, she loses it, her arm. Like, she is physically and mentally really materially damaged by mm-hmm. this experience.
Yeah, so I like looking at as an allegory to the experience of slavery, 100 years later, I think is really effective and really, really useful of kind of understanding and looking at that these have legacies, and these legacies are embodied.
Yeah, these legacies are embodied, and I think it's like really, it's really telling to go back to that idea of Octavia Butler as this really prescient author. It's really telling how in the 1970s she could be writing a novel that gets so well to the heart of how intergenerational trauma works, even though that wasn't a language that people used and it wasn't a way people understood what was happening. Mm-hmm. And the way that she's able to get at that in this like really fantastical story, in this like fantastical predicament that she puts her character in, that is like so violent and so horrendous. She like pulls together all of this stuff, and like we're saying, like the lack of agency in the time travel is part of like what intergenerational trauma looks like, that we don't have, the people who experience it don't have any control over when it emerges or like when it happens or like what you're pulled back into, because these are things that are like, the traumas are not your traumas, but you're so connected to them. And like how well she does it, like talking about fear and like, how Dana is bound to Rufus through fear. Like she gets, they learn that she's being pulled back in moments where his life is in danger. Mm-hmm. And then in moments where she is afraid for her life, she's being sent back to, or like when she, like,
it's not, yeah, like I guess like to be, it's not so much like fear for her life, but like where there is a legitimate and very real threat to her life.
Yes. Where there's, yeah. And then over time, like she and Rufus start off, like he's a young boy, even though he's a white boy in a slave holding society, in white supremacist society, like they start off not in a bad place necessarily, mm-hmm. but over time Rufus becomes more hostile. And like part of that is because of what Dana represents. Dana represents this future possibility of blackness in America, the future possibility of a non-enslaved black person in America that is so counter to the system that Rufus is so embedded in and so invested in, that like he has no, he can only resent her for that future possibility. And so I just think like the parallels to the parable books and like the way that she is in some ways talking about like about survival and also speculation, even though it's a book set in the past, like that's about time travel, there's speculation that's happening in it because she is the speculative future. She is the like the imagined future in the past. And then also she is doing everything in the story about her own survival, right? Like what she is doing in that story is about making sure that she survives into the future and making sure that like her existence can be possible. And like how disgusting and complicated that is in the context of like she's basically saving an ancestor who raped somebody,
who rapes her other ancestor,
yeah, who rapes,
right?
Her,
so like she is a product of this rape that she is almost having to help facilitate,
yeah, and that to, and doing that is about ensuring her continued existence and ensuring her survival. Like I just, the more I think about it, the more I'm just like blown away by all of the like connections and like threads that Octavia Butler is able to do with this story. I think it's just like, it is incredible.
Yeah. Like, so the other, going back to kind of like Rufus's eventual resentment of Dana, I think there's also, it's also really important to look at the ways in which like he is resentful to her as a black woman, because so Rufus loves this, who starts out as this free black woman, and eventually becomes enslaved. And like Rufus is madly in love with her, and she is not in love with him.
Mm.
But like because he is becomes her master, that he is able to force her, himself onto her. But as she kind of pulls away and still tries to run away and ends up dying, whereas I just think Dana then becomes this idea of this free black woman who was never going to love him, right? Like, so like all of this violence is being played out on black women's bodies.
Mm-hmm.
And like the ways in which she is able to bring that in and like bring in the resentment towards black women to be free from themselves is just so important to the story. And like that's where the resentment comes from. So it's like, so like, yeah, like it's all about this black futures, but I think it's also very particularly about the future of a black woman. Like the freedom of black women and freedom for black women's sexuality and autonomy is so important to that book.
Yeah. And so I think putting all three of these together too is that like reading Kindred, you realize like just how much like how deep of and profound a sense Octavia Butler had for the trauma of the history of America.
Yeah.
And when we say America, we don't mean the United States. We mean the Americas. Like,
yeah.
This is all of our history.
Mm-hmm.
And her deep understanding of the trauma of that history carries forward in the parable books in terms of her understanding of, like, what then does that trauma, like, what does that look like for a future in the context of fascism and climate change, like we're saying?
Yeah. Yeah, like, it's so, like, yeah, you're absolutely right. And I think, like...
And not just what does the trauma look like, but then also what does the ongoing struggle for existence and struggle for humanity, like, mm-hmm. how does that strength get transferred forward into the future in the context of collapse?
Yeah, right, like, which makes the ideas around Earthseed so much more real,
mm.
right? Because, like, Earthseed is about... her figuring out a way to build resilience and strengthen her community to the people that she loves, right? So it's just like you kind of have that, you see a little bit of that in Kindred of like the just the basic survival, whereas in the parable she's like it's growing, where it's just like it can't just be about the survival of one individual, it has to be about the survival of us all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it has to be the survival of us all. And she really focuses on survival through this idea of adapting to change,
mm-hmm.
but not just adapting to change, but adapting in ways that create more kindness and that create more empathy and that create like a better world and a better set of relations. And so then I think it's interesting to kind of reflect on where that was going for her as an author, because I think one of the things that I've recently come across around Octavia Butler was the fact that the parable of the sower and the parable of the talents were actually only the beginning of a much larger project for her. So there was a third novel that she had started over 40 times, apparently, called Parable of the Trickster. But that was actually even just supposed to be the middle point in a 7-part series of yeah. books. And she had even mapped out what they were all going to be called. And they all have their different parable titles. You know, like there's a really great website that I'll include a link to in the notes for this episode that does a like really good job of it. Somebody went through and like looked at all the different iterations of the start of Parable of the Trickster and kind of went through like what this shows us for her vision. And one of the things that it shows us was that she wasn't a utopian. And no. like everybody knows this about Octavia Butler. But like that part of what happens going forward is that maybe things don't turn out perfectly. And that in Parable of the Trickster, it starts with, so they've, at the end of Parable of the Talents, part of Earthseed is this idea of setting out to like form new worlds, form new communities around the universe. And Parable of the Trickster starts off in one of those communities where they're cut off from Earth. They can't go back and they all just kind of have to figure out how to live together. But it's not like a perfect story. It's actually a very dark story about like, how do we actually create a different way of being? How does that run up against like our received ways of being together or received like what we might call human nature?
Mm-hmm.
Or how does it like bump up against the like the fact that we're still going to be carrying the threads of all of this intergenerational trauma and all of this oppression into any kind of new place? And like there's a lot of really interesting stuff there. And one of the things that I thought, because I saw a lot of posters that have been going around and memes going around of Octavia Butler with a picture of her with the quote, "There is nothing new under the sun, but there are new suns."
Yes.
And what I didn't know was that was actually the epigraph to Parable of the Trickster.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Which I think is really interesting when put in the context of like the sort of semi-darkness of like what that story
yeah what ends the, up the becoming. Future story was supposed to become
because the future is something we always have to work on,
yeah,
as I think part of like a reality of what she understood.
That's lovely. Mm-hmm. Like knowing that, like, that's really interesting, Because, yeah, like, I've seen that meme going, or the, yeah, meme or picture or artwork going around. And then, yeah, because it's just like that. Because it sounds like such a hopeful phrase, right? Like a hopeful little statement. But, like, understanding that in the context that it's coming out of these talent books where it wasn't quite there, where, like, she gives tools for this, but, like, at the same time, the new worlds are not always going to be better, and that we still have to be able to adapt and work and build.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's really interesting. So I guess here we wanted to kind of rehash what a couple of the conversations that we had had in the first episode that we think are really important dives into kind of like some of the more specifics of what Octavia did in the parable books.
Mm-hmm.
And just kind of rehash them and see if we're in a different place when we talk about them. Yeah, so I think the first one that really struck out to us as a solid critique of these books is colonialism.
Mm-hmm.
So both in the absence of indigenous people, which is very noticeable being that it's set in California, indigenous people aren't a part of the story at all. But also in the ideas around kind of Earthseed. So one of a central tenet of Earthseed is that we should strive to go to the stars. So that is like space travel and seeking out space travel as the next step for humanity. And it's really like the idea of the stars is, what's the word I'm looking for? It kind of makes Earthseed whole. Mm-hmm. It's the piece that's needed to make Earthseed whole.
Well, it's literally called the destiny.
Yes.
Within Earthseed, it is our destiny is to set out to the stars.
Yes, because there's no heaven or hell in destiny. Mm-hmm. So one of the critiques one of the characters makes early on is that, like, well, without any heaven or hell, like, why do people want to participate in your religion? So she believes it as, okay, well, our destiny is go to the stars. And as we go to the stars, that will kind of give us everlasting life, give mm-hmm. us all legacies and everlasting life. Yeah, so, like, I think there are some very strong colonial ideas around that, where, like, humanity should just keep going out and keep expanding and keep exploring as something that makes us human. Yeah, I don't know. What are your thoughts on this stuff?
So, on the case of the first one, the absence of indigenous people and also the absence of a real discussion of colonialism as a foundational element of the Americas, I'm on the same page that I was originally. I think that it's a serious flaw in the story. I think that it's like, I think I said in the original episode, like it's an odd picture of California that has no indigenous people, has no reservations, has no people who have been facing collapse for 500 years negotiating and participating in responses to a fascist climate change driven collapse.
Yeah.
Right? So, like, it's an odd view of California and it's a problem.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other piece of it, on the piece of it that's about the destiny and the, like, and the sort of the idea of setting forth in the stars, reading about the parable of the trickster kind of changed a bit of my perspective on that, because at least the one analysis of where that story goes or could have gone was, like, you know, at the end of Parable of the Talents, the ship that gets sent out gets named the Christopher Columbus.
Yes.
And she's not happy about that at the end, but she kind of lets it go. And what this person talks about in terms of reading the Parable of the Trickster is, like, maybe that's an omen about the fact that this baggage of colonialism is getting attached to Earthseed in a way that it shouldn't really be. And the way that Lauren doesn't actually want it to be, but she's not necessarily empowered to actually shape it and change it. so that this baggage, it's like the threads of the oppression. It comes with it regardless of her efforts for it not to necessarily look like that, or for it not to be colonialism. It's like a different kind of, like, the destiny isn't supposed to be about colonialism. So I have a bit of a different perspective on that piece of it than I did originally, where originally I got to that part and I was just like, are you fucking kidding me? But I think now I'm just like, maybe there was something there that would have been pulled out if she had been able to continue with the story. But I will say that I do think that, you know, like, I think we said this as well in the first episode, there's no reason to take anything away from any of the work that she's doing. I think that, like there's nothing to be taken away from Octavia Butler and her importance and her insight. But I think that there's a lot to be added for thinking through what colonialism looks like in this context and, like, what it means for, like, Indigenous futures.
Yeah. It's really sad that the Parable of the Trickster never got written, right? I think
that is a loss. Because you have so many questions at the end of Talents.
Like, you do. And, so it makes so much sense as understanding that it is, like, this was not the end. That you're right, it does put that on a different light. I think I've always been a little bit softer on the idea of the destiny than you have been. I like the idea of destiny. I also think that the ideas of space and maybe even space travel are things that we shouldn't just throw away. I don't think they have to be colonial, but I think they offer imagination to humanity that we don't necessarily get in other places. Mm. So I've always liked that. Like, I think there's some ickiness in the way she presents it. And like you say, like, the Christopher Columbus is the name of their spaceship, which is just, yeah, which is a little unfortunate. But yeah, I think so. And I agree with, like, the idea around Indigenous futures. And, like, that's Octavia Butler. It's not the only one who does this, mm-hmm. right? It's not possible or fair to throw everything on her. But mm-hmm. I think it's like you said, there's so much more and so many different stories that need to be told. So, like, it's up to us when we're looking at contemporary speculative fiction to make sure that your stories have people of color, they have Indigenous people, they have, like, queer characters. And, like, making sure we're seeking out this futurism that we can all exist in.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And, I mean, part of the aim of that book of short stories that I was talking about was exactly this idea of, you know, Afrofuturism, Indigenous future, like, speculative fiction can't be defined by one person, and it can't be the burden of speculating of our futures can't be placed on one person's shoulders. We need the plethora of voices. We need more of this fiction to be written.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So then the last thing that we had talked about in the original episode that maybe I thought we could come back to was the question about, like, violence in the resistance and in mm-hmm. the social, in the movements that are built in Parable of the Sower and the Talents. And, like, I think you had originally phrased this question around guns, yeah. Because there was just, the talk about guns was just everything, everywhere in those two books. Like, it was just this constant struggle around, where do we get guns? Where do we get ammunition? How do we get bigger guns? And, like,
how do we learn to shoot those guns?
Yeah. Like, and so it raised this question for, I think, both of us of, like, could Lauren and her group have survived without guns? And then also, more broadly, could you organize in a collapse like the one she depicts without guns?
Yeah, and I still don't know if there are actually answers that either of us have to this question, because it's just, like, the dystopia that she presents is so dire. Right, so it's like, when we say there's a fascist government, it's maybe not the best words to be using, because mm-hmm. the government kind of doesn't exist. Mm. Right? The government is absent. So you have this, like, very poor people who are addicted to this really terrible psychotic who are going around robbing and killing people. You have these kind of paramilitary organizations that are, like, hyper-right-wing, hyper-Christian, who are going out and enslaving people and, like, trying to force their religion everywhere. And then you have people who are trying to escape, like, who are trying to escape and go north. And they're just kind of sitting ducks along this highway. So it's just like, yes, how does this work? How is it possible? How can you live without guns? Like, how can you even consider being able to exist without some type of extra protection?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I was thinking about this, too, and I was like, maybe it's like the past couple of years have really changed my perspectives on the world, but I don't have quite as big a problem with this as I did when we originally, because I remember when we originally talked about this. I mean, like, we're both people who get incredibly, like, squirmy around guns and, mm-hmm. like, you know, we can do a privilege check there and be like, this is also about the fact that we don't have to contend with the kinds of violence that are in this book, but that also, like, people in this current world deal with on a regular basis. Yeah. But we also are, like, people who don't want our movements to have to be violent in order to change the world.
Yeah.
But in the sense of thinking about, like, the world, the kind of world that's being created by all of this oppression and all of this violence that's existing right now around us in the real world, like, what are we supposed to do? What are people supposed to do to survive?
Yeah, I absolutely hear that. I don't think my thought process has changed that much. Mm. And I, like, honestly, the way I look at it is Syria. Where, like, you had, and it is complicated, you had this huge peaceful movement come up, massive state violence coming down, the army separates, splits in two, and then you just end up having this horrible civil war, right? So it's just like, I don't necessarily know what the answer is either. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's my inability or lack of imagination, but it's just like, I don't know. It's so difficult. And it's like, I mean, it's not difficult to imagine the world that Butler is bringing forward. But at the same time, it's also almost unimaginable to think of a situation where you have to think about using guns for protection of yourself and your community. Mm. For me, at least.
Yeah. And I think Butler also, like, what I've been thinking about, too, is I think she also challenges the kind of securitization, the like the ramping up of security that happens in the Earthseed community at the end of Sower and through to the beginning of Talents, where it's like, we got to get better guns, we got to get more protection, we got to get this and this and this. But then in the end of the day, they can't use the guns to fight the callers. They can't use the guns to fight these, like, giant tank machines that come in and spray this paralytic at them so that they're, like, I think the thing that's reminding me of and thinking about in the context that we're in, where the RCMP is literally raiding Indigenous lands as we're recording this, like, the state is always going to use more violence. The state is always going to develop stronger ways of attacking. And so, like, maybe she's also kind of pointing to that and being like, you know, there's got to be other, there have to be other things in conjunction with self-defense. That self-defense is not enough.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that also, like, that's a good analysis. And I think you're right. I think she does, like, thinking about it like that, I think she is, like, pushing at that. And then it's at the same time, like, right, like, how do we embrace change? How do we build resilience if we assume that the conditions are always going to be changing? Right. So it's like, yeah, you're right. Like, the securitization and the idea of a gun puts you in a situation where you think things are going to remain the same. Mm. Right. So, like, if you have this gun for protection, you can protect what you have. Whereas if you accept that things are always going to change, you don't necessarily need that.
And she kind of plays that out too in the conflict between Lauren and her partner Bancoli in the Parable of the Talents, where like Earthseed is this little commune style community, and it's constantly under threat, and he wants to respond to this by going to like a more secure community. He wants them to go to a gated community, essentially, which is where she came from. She originally lived in a gated community that couldn't protect her either, because eventually the gates weren't enough. And I think Lauren in some ways is saying this, no, that's just holding on to an idea of what the world is going to be, like you're saying, that is a temporary security, but it's a false one. It's the same way, actually, we had this conversation too. It's the same way that things are getting slightly better or more ordered in Parable of the Talents, because fascism does like a temporary job at making life seem like it's getting better when we allow a fascist government to come in. And then all of a sudden it's just like, but wait a minute, things are actually much, much worse.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I don't really know if there's a happier way to end that.
I think the happy way to end this is to just be, like, really excited about how much attention Octavia Butler's work is getting, how much, like, her work has, like, how much her work has spread, even in the 2 years since we recorded the original episode.
Yeah.
Like, it's just, I think it's amazing and wonderful, and, like, I encourage everyone to just read her books. Is all so relevant to just rethinking and thinking through the world that we're in.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. So we're going to end it there, and we'll be back with another episode in a couple months. And in the meantime, if you're able to leave us a comment on our Instagram, or you can leave us a rating on iTunes, and we'd love to hear your thoughts and feedback on our episodes. We have a tentative plan for this year for our episodes, but as always, are soliciting any recommendations you might have for books that we should be looking at.
Absolutely. I mean, I guess we can give the teaser for the next one. We are looking at immigration stories that don't focus on the United States.
Yeah.
So I think that's going to be very interesting.
Yep.
And exciting.
All right, so we will talk to you next time.
Take care.
Bye.
Music for this podcast is by Ketza from their album Metamorphosis. You can find them at the Free Music Archive or at ketzamusic.com.